You're listening to TalkTainmentRadio.com.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guest and not necessarily those of TalkTainmentRadio.com, the management, the staff, or K&E World Network, LLC.
Yeah, oh Lord, can you come and save her? Better believe they get on their knees, they pray hard, they pray hard, and never look back once the world forgave you.
Welcome to our show today. We are delighted to have our special guest with us. I'm Dr. Dawn Karima, and I'm glad you're here to hear from this truly talented filmmaker. Would you please introduce yourself to us?
Hi, yeah. Hi, Dawn. Thanks for having me back again. My name is Terry Jones. I'm a member of the Seneca Nation of Indians, and we're located about 30 miles south of Niagara Falls. I'm a filmmaker. In the past couple of years, I've had some pretty good success in terms of having my short films that I created during studying film at Syracuse University. They've been accepted and have been screening online or in person before the lockdown and also online now in, I'd say, 30 or 40 film festivals throughout the world.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That is tremendous, and we are so happy for you. Thank you for making time to join us today.
I'm so happy when we can have this time to talk. I don't look at this more as an interview. I look at it more as a discussion, and we're letting people listen in and on our discussion.
Absolutely. I think of it always as if we were just sitting on my back deck or the balcony or the front porch in Cherokee, North Carolina, and just sitting back and having some fresh squeezed lemonade and talking about what's important to us. And so I'm so glad to have this discussion with you because you're so fascinating, and your films, I've had the pleasure of watching them. And one thing that comes to my mind immediately is that you're using some really universal themes. You know, everyone can find something in your work that they can relate to or take an interest in. And so what are some of the themes that you tackle in your filmmaking?
Okay, yeah. During my time studying film at Syracuse University, I was I was a student, and I still am a student of filmmaking, sort of like how do you use film language how to visualize this idea that you have. And sometimes it's not necessarily, I've done narrative, short narrative film.
Mm-hmm.
I've done short documentary, and then I've also done short videos that would be considered experimental. And regardless of those sort of genres of filmmaking, it's telling a story is really universal. It's sort of like when I approach it, I'm like, so how do I want the audience to feel after watching my piece? And a lot of times, a lot of things that I do with my short films is I kind of leave it open-ended. I leave it either unresolved, so that the audience when the film is over, my whole idea is like, well, I hope they just don't watch it and go, well, okay, that was interesting. I've been told that my films are poetic, and sometimes it kind of like follows the viewer after you've watched it. Like with Soup for My Brother is a short documentary I did with my father. In it, he commemorates the 1 year anniversary of his brother's passing. And I think what makes that very universal is that everybody can, it's a somber piece, but at the same time, it's really uplifting because I think with universal stories, I'd like to think that I would leave the viewer feeling like they're less alone, that these sort of processes, not just good processes, that was one thing I learned in film school is like, a lot of, especially narrative storytelling, it's all about conflict. It's all about your protagonist overcoming these obstacles. And that didn't make sense to me at first because I'm like, I'd want to go to the movies to be entertained and see all these successes. But then, as I started to go through it, it did make a lot of sense. Like, everybody goes through certain obstacles. Everybody goes through their own obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always say is that, as well as that the content of our lives may be different, but a lot of times, many, many, many times, there's the processes are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we're talking about, being born, we're living, or we pass away, we can all identify with that. And any of our life experiences in between can be universal.
That's well said. And I feel that there is a wonderful space in your film for us as viewers to reflect and to empathize, but also feel included.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel like that I'm part of the storyline, that I'm somehow included in the process, not just, ooh, look at them, look at what they're doing, you know, look at that.
Yeah.
So how does that impact your audience?
Like I mentioned before, especially with Soup for My Brother, that short documentary actually won Best Documentary in the Liverpool International Film Festival. And as an Indigenous filmmaker, I mean, of course, I make my films for myself and for my community. And of course, I want to, you know, invite the outside world to be able to experience the film as well. But you know, my big dream has always been like, I would like outside, you know, the world beyond Turtle Island, you mm-hmm. know, so over in Europe and over in another one of my short films, Geek Squad, next month is going to be playing at the Waiwora Maori Film Festival in New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be part of the Turtle Islands Shorts program, and I'm going to do a Q&A, and I'm going to call it or zoom into to after the screening. So it's really nice that when, as I said, audiences outside of Turtle Island are able to watch the films. And as I mentioned before, you know, I made these during film school. So at the time, I wasn't like, all right, I'm going to make this film and it's going to screen here and it's going to get in the film festival.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What I've learned since I've graduated is that I've had to, in many ways, grow into my sense of style, the composition of how I tell a story. One of my greatest influences is the British filmmaker Mike Leigh, and also Chantal Ackerman. I think she was French, but their style is something that I really like, where they take very long takes. And, you know, there's no, like, the struggle is more internal. And mm-hmm. so the big conflicts are internal. They're not necessarily actualized in a physical way or in the character's voice. So, mm-hmm. you know, with like, say, Empire State, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Reflection, because in that piece, it's an experimental short film. My father, utilized my father again. He plays a displaced Vietnam War veteran as he's watching invasion, war, and occupation happen. When the outside world infiltrates his world, where he is, through the television, and in that piece, like, everything is reflecting, and physical reflecting, the outside window reflecting off from the picture frame, TV reflecting off my father's face and his army boots. But then not only that, but we also see my father, you know, approach the window as he's mentally reflecting about what he's seeing on television. So it's like, yeah, those sort of instances where you can get an audience to reflect and feel included.
When you think about working with your father, what kind of experience has that been for you?
It's really, really rewarding. I mean, everybody sort of has this, they feel very lucky, because I think everybody has this idea that, you know, our life experiences are unique, and they are to us. Mm-hmm. They're unique to us. And everybody's like, oh, my grandmother or my uncle, you know, he's the best storyteller, he's the best character.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that doesn't always translate, you know, to being a character on film or on video. And you know, and in film school, you know, we're like, all right, we want to do this piece about this Vietnam veteran. Who should we use? You know, we didn't really know personally of any. My film collaborator is Govan DC. We were known as Team Indian, because I'm being Native American or American Indian, and he was actually from India. So, you know, when we first met in film school, we kind of introduced ourselves as an American Indian and an Indian from mm-hmm. India. The class sort of like was confused at one minute, because it's the colonizer's word Indian is used to describe two completely different people with different histories and different cultures and physically in a different place in the world. And here we are in this little microcosm of the classroom, and we're occupying the same space. And so their mind kind of went like, wait, Indian. And I don't know, for whatever reason, we just clicked, and we actually collaborated on almost most of, I'd say a little more than half of the film festivals, or films that made it in the film festivals, was a collaboration with Golden. And with Empire State, we were trying to figure out, like, who we can ask. And, like, who do you ask? You can ask your family. So I'm like, hey, Dad, do you want to be doing this film? And, you know, and a lot of things, too, with especially with my experience with Indigenous elders, is they're really shy when it comes to recording devices. Mm-hmm. So I had to make, like, a compromise with my father. I'm like, okay, don't worry. And Empire State has no narration. It has no dialogue. It's just all soundscapes. Mm. And so, you know, so my father always said, you don't have to say anything. You just got to sit in front of the TV and do these, you know, Indigenous, Native, or Indian things in front of the camera while all this information is coming at you. And, but like I said, so it wasn't until we got him in front of the camera we realized, wow, my dad is really powerful on screen. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until my next project that I did by myself with Soup for My Brother, and I kind of latched on to that, or built upon my father's relatable presence on screen to do this documentary. And what was rewarding, and it's really rewarding, because I look at it more like a collaboration, especially with Soup for My Brother, my short doc, is really a collaboration between my father and myself. And, you know, I really cherish those the luck I've had that to be able to have an idea and to actualize it with someone who's close to me. And actually, my father and I will be collaborating again at the end of this summer. My next short film that I'm going to do is called Osno, and that means bark in Seneca. And that's a story that's in Soup for My Brother. My father recounts how he stole his grandfather's butcher knife. Mm. And him and his brother, they go into the woods, and they take that knife, and somehow they break off the tip of the knife. So they stab that knife into a very young tree. And then in the film, my father, or the documentary Soup for My Brother, my father goes back and to that tree, and you can actually see the knife blade. Of course, the tree has grown around the knife, the blade itself, but the handle is still sticking out of the tree. So,
wow.
You know, 65 years later, it's still there. So I'm going to be doing a short film based on that experience about a 13-year-old boy who steals his grandfather's butcher knife. And it has more to do with, and this again is a universal theme, I think, in terms of like preserving language, preserving culture. It's about a grandfather who's trying to pass this knowledge onto his grandson. And this takes place in the 1950s, but the grandson is really kind of obsessed and more interested in war, you know, especially World War II. It had just happened like 10 years before. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of like this conflict between, you know, the youth and an elder. And, you know, so that's the gist of what the story is. So I'm really looking forward again to collaborating with my father in that. What makes this one a little bit more challenging is that it's being translated fully into the Seneca language. And so I'm going to have to try to find a way to, you know, to make this film completely in Seneca with English subtitles. So it's exciting, but daunting at the same time. And you got to take a risk, and that's what I'm doing. So
I can't wait to see it. I mean, I truly know it's going to be excellent. I really do. And I think there's a wonderful synthesis there. I mean, you're looking at family bonds and language and culture and life ways and all of these things that contribute to cultural survival. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, when you think about making a film that's entirely in your own language, what does that language mean to you?
What got me first interested, I was when I was younger, there was a summer enrichment program, and one of the first summer program was photojournalism. So mm-hmm. We were like 13, 14 years old. The program built a black and white dark room. Back then, we were taking pictures with actual film. And so we put paper, this newspaper together called the Reservation Times, and we would go out and talk, you know, to the local lacrosse, you know, the lacrosse coach and other projects. A new bridge was going up, so we're like, all right, what's this bridge about? So, but it was during the capturing this moving image, or not, the still image was what really captivated me and say, wow, you can really capture a moment in time that's forever. Aside from now with Photoshop, then everything becomes liquid. Like you can change anything in a photo that mm-hmm. you see doesn't necessarily mean that it's capturing the actual moment. But it was at that time, and then when I, you know, of course we went, you know, we had saw movies and we had, you know, the moving image through through our television. But it was during that time when I realized, I was like, wow, I'm like, in terms of Native American history and Seneca history, like those are only captured in an image. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't hear them. We can't, you know, there's a fire in that picture. We can't smell that fire. We can't feel what they're doing if they're, mm-hmm. if they're like doing lacrosse. So for me, it was a matter of being able to wonder what they would have told us, the future generation, if we could, if at that time and that still picture was taken, like, what would you tell the future generations? And they may have said, you know, keep your language, preserve your language, mm-hmm. fight for your sovereignty, fight for your land, don't give up your land. Like, but we don't have that. And so I kind of feel like with me being a filmmaker now, I might be able to in turn tell the future, you know, the future generations beyond myself and beyond us. I'm like, what is it that we can, I have that now, that ability to not just capture a still image or just capture, you know, sight and sound, but also important messages that our elders can tell our future generations, which is probably going to be the same thing, you know, preserve the language, maintain your sovereignty, you know, take care of Mother Earth, you know, take care of one another, take care of our elders and our unborn and the environment. So that's sort of where the you know, the overall umbrella of like where my head is when I'm thinking about my pieces, that's sort of like, that's who I am. That's how I was raised. So it's not that hard to do it, to kind of put those sort of themes of, you know, sometimes they can be daunting, but for me in the end, I want the audience or the viewer to walk away and say, huh, I never thought of it like that before. Or, right. Yeah, I experienced that, but I didn't. But, you know, history tends to repeat itself. So I'd like to think that the things that I couldn't hear or see in those still images when I was a youth, that I'm now, you know, actualizing that in video and in film.
You are, amazingly so. And when you use the word history, what immediately comes to my mind is that so many times people relegate indigenous people to the past. Mm-hmm. You know, the majority of films about native people and even many other kinds of tribal and indigenous people across the globe still are past tense, pre-colonial, the Western, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's no space where people are just, you know, now we have Rutherford Falls, but mm-hmm. there are very few spaces where people are just living their life. And so one of the things I see in your films is that you're doing a really amazing job of balancing between, you know, reverence for culture and respect for history and an appreciation of tradition and modernity.
Mm-hmm.
How's that working for you?
It was sort of like when I grew up, I mean, we have this concept of the two-row wampum, and it was the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee was sort of like this treaty that we made with the, or an understanding we made with the Dutch, was that mm-hmm. Two parallel lines occupying, and they represented the Indian canoe and the white man's ship, and they're, as I said, two parallel lines, purple parallel lines in a sea of white, which is more or less a river. And the understanding was that we will stay in our canoe and you will stay in your ship, and those lines will stay parallel, will never impede each other. But we also know that historically, the ship has always knocked into the canoe, you know, and we're kind of taught, as well as individuals, you know, growing up, they're like, you know, you can't have 2 feet, and you can't have a foot in the ship, and you can't have a foot in the canoe, because what if they go in different directions? You end up falling in, you know, into the water. But, you know, but then the way the world, you know, the way history sort of evolved, and the way that the outside world has really, the dominant culture has really influenced, you know, all cultures, all indigenous cultures in the world, more or less. There's very few left, that we really do have to have 1 foot in the ship and 1 in the canoe. And it's more or less a balance to, I mean, the key is more or less to find that balance so that, you know, you have 1 foot firmly planted in the canoe there. That's your history, that's your culture, that's your language. And you kind of have 1 foot in the modern world, and, you know, hopefully, you know, you won't step off the canoe and just totally go in the boat, in the ship, because that happens. And you know, there's a lot of people here in the territory. They, you know, they have TVs and they watch movies and stuff, but they more or less have both feet kind of firmly planted in the canoe. So I feel very fortunate that I find this balance between the two. So I'm not overwhelmed by the dominant culture, because it's a really outside world. You know, I lived in New York City for 20 years, and it's a totally different world than the territory. And I kind of saw that in the outside world. When you meet someone, it's not who are you, you know, who are you, you know, hey Don, nice to meet you, who are you? It's more or less, hi Don, what do you do?
Yeah,
and
what
so
do you
much
do?
Of yeah, and so much of the outside world is based on what you do, is dictates on, you know, it's your age, it's your sex, it's what, you know, what kind of clothes you wear, where do you live, what do you, you know, what's your job? Those are the things that define you, and not necessarily of who you really are. And it's sort of like that sort of thing is what I like to put into my films, is that strip away all the things. You know, we all come into this world, you know, naked with nothing. I mean, kind of leave the same way as well. So no matter how much, what material wealth and things that you gain, you can't take it with you. So and for the most part in my films, I'd like to keep those kind of things stripped away and say, okay, what is our universal human experiences, and how can I get audiences, or how can I get the viewer to identify with these characters, or with these situations, or these storylines?
Well, I'm so interested in what you're saying, because what I see now, you mentioned earlier about a lot of our elders, you know, are reticent when it comes to recording devices or film, or even, you know, I've done a lot of work with language immersion, and we'd ask them, will you speak for us? Will you tell us a story, you know, and oh my goodness, you know. And yet, if we flash forward to our younger generation, they're on TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
They're a whole native culture TikToks, you know, they're not shy about this technology at all. What do you see when you see the future of film?
So when I was younger, you know, when you're a younger individual, you kind of feel like time is forever.
Right.
And you kind of feel like I will live forever. I will live, you know, that's way in the future. It's undefinable, you know, sort of thing. But, for me right now, where I am in my life, in terms of where I am, I'm not part of the younger generation, and I'm not quite an elder. I'm somewhere in the middle. And the way I like to look at it is like, it's almost like a relay race now. So I have a baton in one hand, and I'm passing it back to the younger generation now through my film work. But at the same time, I'm grabbing the baton from the future, from the elders, and they're giving me the knowledge or guidance or mentorship that I need in ways, because I don't know everything. We all don't know everything. It's like a call. Sort of like, look at the, as an individual, we're a culmination of all of our life experiences, good and bad. And as a people, and as a group of people, like Senecas, together, it's our culmination of our people's history that makes us Seneca. It's not just one person. So that sort of concept is where I feel that where I am right now, I'm passing the baton back to the youth, and then I'm grabbing from the front, and hopefully in the future, hopefully the younger people will realize that maybe a little sooner than I am, that, you know, they have in some ways this responsibility to understanding the dire situations that we have with the environment, especially the environment, mm-hmm. and also with language and with you know, maintaining our identity. And and with social media the way it is now, you know, it can be a good thing, and same with any new technology, it can be good and it could be bad. I tend to look at things not necessarily in an ideal way, in terms of like, well, you know, where's that magic wand? Let's make everything perfect and make everything mm-hmm. justified. Just, you know, sometimes it's a matter for me is how can I contribute to make things less worse? And I don't want to make it sound like I'm being pessimistic. I'm not. But
right.
as I said, but when we live in a culture, especially when we interact and we're affected by the dominant culture, we're like, this is what money can do for you. This is happiness. This is what happiness looks like.
Mm.
You know, this is what success looks like. And so it's almost like built in where it's unattainable in the way that it's presented to us. So we always feel lacking. So you're always like, oh, I'm never going to get that car, or, you know, so-and-so drives a beautiful car and I won't have that. But hey, but I'm doing better than my neighbors. So I feel better about myself in that way. And, you know, I kind of look at it that way, that it's that those sort of living in ideals doesn't work for me. And for
mm-hmm.
me, it's a matter of like, how can I use my film works to, as I said, make things less worse? Because I feel like those are more quantifiable, say, a year ago. And I'm like, you know what, my works were doing this. But now this year, this spring, like I'm in 7 or 8 different projects. And it's not just film festivals. It's community groups. You know, one of my short films is being used in an African-American and Native youth group where
mm-hmm.
they're watching film I talked about earlier, Empire State. They're watching that, and then they're going to write an essay about it. And another one that I had done last month, or that another one of my projects, Ode to the Nine, was in this prisoner correspondence program where they help LGBTQ prisoners have access to short films, and then they too will identify and then write an essay about it. So it's really rewarding for me to see that, you know, that it's not just something that appears on a screen or appears online in a film festival, that it actually has more profound, you know, aspects of influencing people's lives.
I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoy our conversation so much, is because you do have dimensions. You know, your work is transforming lives, and it's also reaching wide audiences, and it's satisfying for you. And there's so many things that are happening in it and because of it that's really fascinating to me. Wow, this is one of my very favorite things about this show, is that we have such great conversations. And we'll have more of this one when we come back from break.
COVID-19 is a killer, and it's killing Black people at a higher rate. We make up 75% of COVID deaths in D.C., but we can change that. COVID-19 is passed through droplets and suspended particles in the air. That's why wearing a mask is critical. Face masks combined with physical distancing would help reopen the economy more safely and crush a second or third COVID wave. Wear a mask for your family, friends, and you.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No, but you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
My son Casey was a bright, fearless 20-year-old with a boundless future ahead of him. But in the blink of an eye, he was gone. While out riding a skateboard, Casey fell. He was not wearing a helmet. Our whole family wishes he was. It could have saved his life. I'm Captain Kevin Raffelli of the San Mateo Police Department. Parents, encourage your kids to strap on a helmet every time they jump on a bike, scooter, or skateboard. Think of my son Casey and use your head. Put a helmet on. It could save your life.
A message from the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
I am really enjoying this. This is so much fun, and I'm learning so much, and I'm so glad that we get to talk about these beautiful things some more. When people come to the film festivals and they see your films, what do you really hope deep down inside will happen as a result of a screening?
My production company is called Torn Jersey Media, torn. And one of the things is that, as I mentioned before, it's not only entertain, educate, but it's also to reflect. And mm-hmm. It's those sort of main three components of my film projects. And I think what makes it universal to not just, because I wouldn't want to do something where my community would say, well, you're showing us something we all know. We all know that, you know. Mm-hmm. You're trying to cater to the outside world so that you can educate them. But at the same time, I want the outside world to be entertained and be educated. And for an example, in Suit for My Brother, I have my great-grandfather's voice where he's giving, they call it Gonyonyuk, which means the Thanksgiving address. And
yes.
In that, you know, we give thanks to everything, to the stars, the plants, planets, the water, moon, you know, that he does that. But the audio in that is at a level that, of course, my dad's narrating, but to a non-native watching it, they're like, I want to hear more of it, because my great-grandfather's voice was so pronounced and so sort of like how my father is on screen. It's so people gravitate towards it because his mm-hmm. voice is very soothing and very deep. So I think it's really
you're hoping that your audience will feel, receive, do as a result of watching your screenings.
Yeah. For the most part, it's to get them to, again, to be entertained, to educate them, and also to get them to reflect. And hopefully in the end, you know, and when your Twitter bio, you can only have so many different characters. And, yeah. And in that, I always have mine to humanize the other through film and video.
Mm.
And when I say other, everybody can identify with being other. And, you know, it doesn't matter what gender you are, what color you are, what sexual orientation you are, no matter if you're rich or poor or whatever, we can all at one point, hopefully you can identify with being labeled an other. And mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of what, for the most part, is that I want, when someone watches my films, I want them to know that they're not alone, and they're not, I always say the content of our lives may be different, but the processes are the same. And
mm-hmm.
And in the end, I sort of like, and I've heard that about my work. It's been called poetic in some ways. And but for the most part, it's like, it kind of haunts them after they watch it. It's not just like, you know, you watch it, I'm like, wow, that was interesting. I'm done. It's sort of like, what did happen to that anthropologist when that trickster disappeared in the film? And what happened to, you know, the Vietnam veteran, you know, after the movie ends, you know? And when people ask me that at screening sometimes in in-person Q&As, I'm like, well, that's up to you to decide. You know, it's not really laid out. You know, in a couple of our films too, there's not a mother. I don't know if it's because I think they say that about Disney films. Like a lot
yes.
of the main characters, they don't have moms. And in one of my films, Grit, the mother, there's no mother. It's just a father and a son. But not many people ask. You know, and I'm sort of, and when, you know, after we made it, we're like, where is the mom? Where'd the mom go? sort of thing.
That's so interesting because I am a mom.
a relatively new mom, and I noticed that, especially since you have such a strong matrilineal culture.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, where's, and you're right about Disney and so many other cartoons that in order to become autonomous or, you know, to self-actualize somehow, we have to, you know, kill off Bambi's mom and all. Then the Lion King switches it up, right? They kill off a father so that he can be king. Yeah. But I have noticed that before, and I'm interested in that because it does create a really different sort of perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sort of, and it wasn't necessarily deliberately, I guess. Like with that movie that I talked about, Grip, it's about a father and son, and they're more or less, they're poor, and they're hungry, and so the father has to go deer hunting, and so, you know, hunt a deer in order to survive, and what we learn in the film is that through a flashback, and this is based on true life experience with my uncle, the main character who's portrayed by my brother, he flashes back to when he was a kid and he went deer hunting with his father, and he has a heart attack and dies on the hunting trip.
Oh,
and
goodness.
So, in our short film, Gripped, it, up to that point in time, the father seems sort of distant from the son, and you don't understand why.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
My mother, when she first saw it, she's like, why is he so mean to the boy? And I'm like, it'll all make sense in the end. And it wasn't until he had to kill that deer and experience a happy result, more or less, a happy result in terms of them being able to survive in the end by killing a deer, is what in the end is the father and the son are sharing this experience together. And in that way, you know, like we mentioned, it wasn't so much that we deliberately left out the mother, but it was just sort of made sense in terms of it's just the two of them. And that is real life. Sometimes the mother isn't there. Sometimes the father isn't there.
Right.
You know, sometimes the child or the main character might be a kid who doesn't have either parent. In terms of storytelling, I guess sometimes that reflects. It wasn't deliberately left out, especially, coming from a matrilineal society or a culture that we wouldn't have a mother. In the other film we did, Unearth, which is a narrative, we do have a grandmother in there, but then there too, the mother's missing. And there we were really aware of that, because we're like, okay, here's the story. Because what I really appreciated with stories, films that have really impacted me, is how detailed they are. Everything makes sense, not just in the set design. Like, wow, that bedroom looks real. Like, I would love to be in that bedroom. I would like to peek around in the books, or look through mementos, or look through a cabinet to see what's there. With Unearthed, it's sort of like we made sure that there were no plot holes or character, that the dialogue was authentic. And in that, we said, okay, the father and son come and live with the grandparents, and because the mother died, even though it's not said in the film at all, and it's not spoken about, but that was our story that made sense. And sometimes people will ask, you know, where the mother is, and we have an answer for it. And it's not just like, oh, good question. I don't know. You know, I don't know why. And
that's really important, I think. I think that's a sign that kind of engagement is really important for all artists to a point. I'm thinking about, a lot of people do that to me with my books, especially my novels. They want to know what happened to so-and-so, and they want to know, you know, are Manna and Thomas okay, or, you know, what happened? And I do know. Like, I really do know. I know they're just fine. I wouldn't have left them there if they weren't. I got them to where they're fine, and they're going to be okay. But it is always amazing to me how many people are so deeply engaged. They hope it will be all right. They are concerned about the characters, and that means somehow they've been transported out of where they were to where you are creating a world. And so who inspires you, or which filmmakers really engage you?
So growing up, you know, there were not a lot of just native indigenous artists as well, but the world was a lot smaller then. You know, we didn't we didn't have the internet, and you didn't have YouTube. Say, oh wow, look at this, you know, this traditional artist in, you know, Diné or Navajo country. You know, look at them. Like, we were more or less spiraling in our own universe here on my territory. And so I didn't have any famous photographers or filmmakers who I wanted to emulate. So it wasn't until I got older and then went to film school that I kind of found, you know, and of course, everybody has their own preference to their genre of movie that they like. You know, a lot of people like horror films and a lot of people like comedy films. And for me, it's more about drama, and not drama in terms of like, oh, you're so dramatic, you know, sort of thing, you know, over the top. But it's more about internal conflicts, you know. So, but it was British filmmaker Mike Leigh. He's done like Secrets and Lies. He's done a whole bunch of stuff now. Career Girls, but in his films, aesthetically, what I like about it is that he takes very long takes. And from what I've seen, there's really no, and you'll see, as you saw in my film, there's really no fast cuts, which is kind of, in some ways, I think, refreshing, especially in this digital world that we live in now. Mm-hmm. Everything is just like so fast, and your brain sometimes doesn't even have time to think about what it's seeing. It's sort of like they're dictating to you what you'll see. And and so with Mike Leigh's films, very long takes, time for the audience to reflect on what the character is going through, but also in a way where the viewer is able to maybe reflect upon themselves and their life experiences. And in terms of him, you know, in his films, it's not a big, you know, like a blockbuster film where, you know, the world's in peril and about ready to get blown up, you know, sort of thing. His films are more conflicts of internal conflicts. And so I've gravitated toward those. So as you saw in my films, you know, there is no big shoot 'em up or big explosions or anything like that. It's more internal. And Chantal Ackerman was another filmmaker that influenced me. She did this piece called, I think it's in French. I think it's called East to West. And she just goes along these different environments in Europe and takes these very long takes, sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes long, letting you know, at a wedding or on the beach or in the city and people waiting in the snow, waiting for the train. But just sort of like those moments I really appreciated that. And so I've incorporated those into my films as well. But I'm not copying it. And that's the thing that I've kind of known is like everybody's, and when I went to film school, everybody's like, oh, they wanted to be the next Tarantino. But, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like, well, he already exists, you know.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah. And same with me. I mean, you know, Sherman Alexis. That you know, everybody kind of uses that as the beginning of like contemporary indigenous cinema with Smoke Signals, but that in itself was its own entity, you know, and you can't recreate it. Like, I wouldn't want to try to recreate it. But I think what's universal about it is that when you do have a film like that, a monumental film like that, there are elements, there are characters, there are situations there where someone goes, "That's me, that's my res." Yeah, we drive a car. We've had a car that could only drive backwards. You know, or you know, something about fry bread. For me, it's corn. It's Iroquois white corn. So there's usually some element of corn in my films. And but it's like those sort of things that that transcend the filmmaker. It becomes sort of like the public domain where the public can identify with certain elements and they end up owning it. And you know, I'd like to think in some ways that my short films right now are able to do that as well, where people are like, that's mine, that's me, you know, that's my grandfather.
That is so powerful, because I don't know for sure, but I have a theory that all stories are family stories. It's mm-hmm. just how you define the relatives, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're creating these family stories, and yet in this sort of new modern age, we actually have the selfie, for example, or these videos that people make of themselves and only themselves, right? No reference to anyone else, no inclusion of anyone else. Do you think that individuality is a good thing for film, or could it be detrimental?
I think in some ways, especially now with, like, these especially with these filters that are on, like, TikTok and Instagram, mm-hmm. sort of, like, I think it really plays in, and I'm generalizing here, I'm not saying necessarily Indigenous people, but I think it plays on people's sense of ego and sense mm-hmm. of, you know, how do I get make myself more alluring or attractive? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's kind of like the opposite. I'm sort of like, yeah, I'm an individual, but I'm also a collective at the same time.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, how do I make it an experience that it's not just about myself? You know, I may be the filmmaker, but I more or less feel like, you know, people are like, well, how did you get that story, or how does that come out? And I'm like, you know what? I in some ways really believe that the stories are the ones that want to be told. I'm just yes. sort of like the vessel mm-hmm. that makes it happen, that actualizes it. Because once a story idea comes in my mind, then it just sort of grows, and the characters will start not talking to me, but will say, well, my brain will start to figure out, okay, so they go there, but then what happens? You know, and then how do I end it? How do they, you know, how do they resolve what they're going through? And, but yeah, it's really interesting to see how we, to get the youth to kind of, in some ways, hopefully it's just a fad that's going yeah. through, where people are like, it's all about me.
Right, me.
Yeah, but that's sort of like how it's always been. We've always, you know, we internalized ourselves through, you know, acceptance from, you know, our, you know, sometimes we're our worst critics, our own worst critics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sort of seek that sort of permission or acceptance from outside of ourselves. And hopefully there's a certain point when you realize that, you know, I mean, and it's funny to say it, but sometimes the youth, you're like, well, okay, someday you're going to get older and your looks aren't going to be, you know, right. the way that you think they are now, you know, mm-hmm. and where are you going to be then? What are you going to have then? You know, sort of thing. And, but those are, you know, again, that's another like universal story of like narcissists.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just interesting on how, you know, how you can incorporate those sort of lessons into you know, storytelling, whether it's print or, you know, video or film.
One thing that comes to mind is technology. And I know in the art world, so often in all the arts, we run into sort of sometimes battle lines. People who think technology is great, still important, absolutely necessary. And then the purists who say, oh no, you know, technology is somehow the enemy of true and pure communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but yet technology is what's allowing so many of us to make film, to make mm-hmm. video, to make content. You know, if we had to wait for a big studio to sign us, mm-hmm. we might not be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel mm-hmm. about that?
Yeah, I when I went to film school, you know, well, first, I didn't really want to go to film school or art school in general, because I'm like, I'm my own individual person. I have my own unique artistic view of the world, and I don't want to be tainted by other people's, you know, ideas.
Oh,
and,
dear.
And things like yeah. that. You know, and that's my ego. That was my mm-hmm. ego talking through that. And once I got into film school, then I realized, like, oh, okay. You know, that saying they say, you know, you can't break the rules unless you know them. And so I had to, you know, I had to come into within myself to be like, well, yeah, you might be a unique individual artist, but you should really see what's out there before you. And so that in some ways you can carve out your own niche based on what you've seen. And that's what I did at Syracuse was not only understanding the creative process, but also the history of it. And when you think about film, any new technology that comes out, especially brand new technology, tends to be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to only be accessible to certain socio-economic, you know,
right.
layers in our society. They
mm-hmm.
have access to
that
it first.
True.
And with film, that's why it happened. You know, nobody, you know, marginalized or underrepresented peoples at that time didn't have access to to this expensive technology of film. And then in the late 60s, and I'm regurgitating what I learned in film school, but in the late 60s, when video came along, it was the same thing. There was only a certain sector of people who could afford a video camera. You know, they were like $4,000 or $5,000 each, and so they were the ones that were telling the story. And I think overall, that's sort of what this comes down to, is like, who's telling the history, who's telling the story. And mm-hmm. at those points in time, with the invention of film, moving image, and then with video, it was especially in underrepresented communities or marginalized communities, they weren't the ones telling the stories. It was the outside world telling it for them. But now you look at technology today, and you look at, especially with the cell phone, and I still can't believe this, iPhone 11 that I'm talking to you right now takes 4K images.
Yeah.
It can capture so much more mm-hmm. color than our eyes can even see. And
yes.
In some ways, it's a great equalizer to making this, especially with storytelling, equalizing who's telling the story. We're telling
right.
it for ourselves, and we're doing it our way. It's just a matter, and in some ways I'm saying unfortunately, but TikTok is a way of storytelling. It's just done in a really short amount of time. When I say my short films are like 3, 4, 5 minutes long, and and in the end you kind of have this twist, but it's now I think with TikTok and those sort of really shorter formats is it's all up front. You know, there's no time to have story development, character development. It's all the joke or whatever you're doing is on display, right, mm-hmm. as it's happening.
Well, all kinds of people now can enter the chat, it used to be that perhaps, the studio system and even what we called independent film still had to have financiers and backers and all of that, or it was a tremendous undertaking. It took people years of their lives, and all their credit cards were maxed out. And I'm thinking about Killer of Sheep and Hollywood Shuffle, where people had to really fight to get things made. And now the content that's coming out of Appalachia, for example, and reservations and marginalized communities or communities we don't even know. I mean, even people, not just geographic communities, but social communities and all kinds of folks are able to be on YouTube, right? Or mm-hmm. are able to put it there, and all of us are able to see it. And even social mm-hmm. media allows us to see all this representation. And so, when you start thinking about that, does it change film? I mean, I remember when people bought a ticket and mm-hmm. popcorn and sat in the theater and watched the latest movie and could not wait to see a blockbuster on the big screen. And then, of course, streaming services have made those blockbusters available if you're willing to wait a little bit or even not really wait mm-hmm. that much with Amazon Prime and Hulu and stuff. You can see HBO Max. You can see them right away.
Mm-hmm.
So does this change the film experience? How we literally, we used to sit in the dark and maybe crunch
yeah.
popcorn, but that's it. And now, we're watching a blockbuster while we're texting on our phone.
Or you're on the treadmill. There is something really unique about being in a dark room with a bunch of people, strangers, and this shared experience of, especially in a great film. I mean, it's all personal in terms of what you think a great film is. I mean, there's mm-hmm. the blockbusters that people think are great, but sometimes they could be art house films that people think are just as great. And what was the last comment that you made? There was something that was kind of...
Well, we're talking about how it's changed from, film being an event. We're all going
yeah.
to see this film, and we're preparing our mind, and it's the only thing we're going to focus on, except maybe our snacks, And
yeah.
to I'm watching it on my phone, I'm watching it.
Yeah.
I'm watching it while I'm kicked back, relaxing at the house. Does this change what the film means to our society?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the people who... and it's not, before lockdown, it wasn't that long ago when you were like, okay, we have an idea, or we know the experience of going to the theater or going to
mm-hmm.
the cinema. But then we have this huge younger generation that their whole life experience has been on tactile devices,
right.
mm-hmm. iPhones and iPads. And so it's sort of like, how can you miss something if you've never had it? So they might not mm-hmm. have that experience of being in the mm-hmm. in the theater, and they don't miss it. They don't see the in some ways the degradation of the experience. And I know for a filmmaker, you're like, yeah, you know, everybody has these aspirations. Like, yeah, I want it to be at Sundance or the Toronto International Film Festival.
Right.
You
mm-hmm.
know, in a dark room. I want to have that experience. I want people to experience that way. And what I'm finding is I don't really have. I think the end result for me is. I don't do it with that in mind where I'm like, it has to be in a theater. I understand that there's many different ways that films can be experienced, and especially being a little small fry, you know, like myself right now, I guess I'm emerging, but, and 5 of my short films are on Amazon Prime. They were free. They were a part of the subscription, but something happened in the last month where it became a paywall. So now it's still cheap. It's like 99 cents. But I do, you know, my films are on Amazon Prime. But for the small fries, you know, we're sort of like, well, we'll take any way that we can get it. And what I think is the what I've learned in film school or in general is common knowledge is that sometimes things gain value, not just monetary value, but even artistic value through scarcity. And so I kind of thought, wow, that's really stingy of the artist. You know, you should make it accessible to everybody, you know, sort of thing. And in some ways, I felt that way towards at that time, before I started making my films, I felt that towards Indigenous filmmakers. I'm like, I heard of that film, but I can't see it. I don't know where to get it. And if I want to buy it, you know, through this distributor that's charging $300,
right.
I'm like, that's really, you know, inaccessible. But then, you know, my own life, my own experience comes up. And then, you know, all the films that that still have a life 5 years later after graduating, they were all on YouTube. I put them on YouTube for a good year. And it wasn't until I graduated. And then I got in the film festivals, and then the film festivals are like, your works cannot be publicly accessed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, it does make sense. I mean, why would someone go buy a movie ticket to, you know, for a program in a film festival if you can just watch it on YouTube? So I had to take my work down. I had to take all my work down, you know. And so here I'm like, geez, I'm going against exactly what I said. I'm like, hey, free the work. Let people see your films. You know, don't make them scarce. And yeah, so it's kind of interesting in terms of how I kind of view, you know, how we view the experience of the viewer. You know, back when I was, you know, I am sounding like an old man.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want me to get your rocking chair for you?
Yeah. And he said, there in my rocking chair.
I'm playing.
Back in my day, when we went to the Longhouse, we didn't wear our outfits. You know, we didn't, you know, spend hours, you know, putting all these detailed beads on it, but this is what we're doing now, and it's, you know, and that's up to me as well to adapt, you know. And I'm sure there's things that I do as an artist in film that people would say, no, don't do that, you can't do that, or that's too ornate, you know, that's too much exhibition. And those are the things that I want to explore in grad school and torture myself. I still have nightmares of missing assignments in school and all that, but there's something about me that finds it challenging. And but also the environment itself, sometimes when we're left to our own devices, you know, we're not as motivated and we're not as structured as we could be. And I sort of and I'm still not done learning. There's so much more in film, you know, even though, you know, I have this success that I've had for myself, I'm by no means the be-all end-all filmmaker. You know, there's a lot of things I don't know, and there's a lot of things that I still have to learn. And I do have hope that, you know, I will have future pieces that will be, that won't be class assignments, you know. So the one thing that I've learned since graduating from Syracuse with my undergrad is that, and I mentioned this earlier, that I do have a sense of style. I do have a sense of way of storytelling, a certain aesthetic that people identify with. So me going into grad school now, I will go in and own that. I will own myself in that, and not try to be the next Tarantino or try to make the next Smoke Signals, or, you know, or even for myself to make the next Soup for my brother. I mean, I wouldn't, because, you know, the amount of success and acceptance that it's received, you know, sort of like, well, how do I recreate it? How do I recreate it? You know, sometimes it just happens. And I'm hopeful, very hopeful.
I'm hopeful for you. Thank you so much for having this great conversation with us today. I'm so glad you joined us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And like I just feel like we're having a conversation and we're just letting everybody else listen in.
Exactly. That's right. And it's been wonderful.
By two fellow nerds.
Who love film.
Yeah, me too.
I'm so excited that you were here today, and I'm so thankful our audience is here with us to listen and to share. And we can't wait for next time.
You got the power. The world's greatest radio. Talktainmentradio.com.